You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
The Super Bowl is done. Football is behind us. It's time for the Major League Baseball season, and that means this week we tour the National League Central and look back at the off seasons that were. Kerry Muscat already down in the Valley of the Sun. Got there a little early, Kerry. Are you just eager and excited to go?
No, my landlord insists that I rent for the full month. So in order to maintain the condo and the lifestyle I'm accustomed to, I decided to come down to Arizona early. And anyone up north, if they look at the forecast in Chicago and they look at the forecast for the Phoenix area for the week, they will understand even more why I'm down here early. So it's supposed to be 80s all week.
Ah, yeah. So you're enjoying pleasant weather. And
yes,
getting ready for the season. And I'm reading that Jake Arrieta, he's on Twitter interacting with the fans and all that in advance of him avoiding arbitration with the Cubs. They have come to a deal, I understand.
Yes, Mr. Arrieta, rather than they were scheduled for a hearing, which would have been Tuesday this week, and instead of doing that, they were able to come to an agreement on a $10.7 million deal. I think, Jake, that's a significant lifestyle raise considering he was only making three-something last year. So I'm sure he'll be fine. He can afford a new Pilates machine and more tank tops, and he'll be just great.
Yeah, so that's good news. And I always think if you can, you got to avoid arbitration, especially when you have guys like Jake Arrieta who are such big pieces of what is going to transpire this year with the Cubs. Yeah, you just want people to be in the right frame of mind.
Well, yeah, any player that I've talked to that's gone through the arbitration process doesn't like it. I mean, you have to sit there and listen to people tell you why you don't deserve the money. And no one wants to hear negative stats or negative information like that. So any way they can avoid anything like that is much better. I'm just happy to see that they were able to get it done. I know Arrieta wasn't happy when they first exchanged figures and the Cubs had made an offer at 7.5. But the thing is, it's part of the process. It's part of the whole dance that the team and the players, agents do before they reach an agreement. And he actually did a little, certain websites predict what a normal raise would have been. An area went a little higher than that. I know there's been some talk about maybe getting him a long-term deal, but I guess if it were me, I'd sort of like to see how he follows up last year. He set a record number of innings pitched. He was a little fatigued at the end of the year. Not that Jake is not going to be in great shape and not ready for 2016, but I'd sort of like to see, if I'm a team and if you're looking at it strictly from a business standpoint, let's wait and see what he does and how he approaches 2016, and then we'll talk extension.
Yeah. Well, as clearly you're in Arizona and spring training beckons, the Super Bowl is even completed, so it's time to really think about what has been accomplished with this last offseason with the Cubs. Reviewing what they got done, and three names really jumped to the fore for me. Jason Hayward, John Lackey, Ben Zobrist. Who's the biggest, most important addition?
Well, it's kind of, I guess the way I look at it, it's Lackey. Because one, it really just fills a spot in their rotation, and it just gives them so much depth. And he's the kind of guy that he's buddies with Lester. The two of them, in watching their exchanges during the Cubs convention and when the team was in Chicago in January, it was really obvious that the two guys play well off each other. They like each other. In fact, Lackey was coming to Arizona early from what I was told. So, the pitchers and catchers don't have to report until the 19th. Here it is the first part of February, and Lester's already throwing, and Lackey's supposed to be coming very soon. Those are all good signs. But Lackey slides in behind Arrieta and Lester. Nice. It's just, if I'm another team and I'm looking at the Cubs rotation coming in, that's a pretty powerful punch to go, Arrieta, Lester, Lackey. And it, it also, you know, they don't have to, the Cubs maybe don't have to stress as much as to the depth in the minors as to who can, you know, fill in those other gaps, who they need. I think he might be the kind of the one key guy. He's got a certain edginess to him. You know, Joe Maddon likes that. The Cubs front office likes that. And you can get, you can justify that if you're a winner in the field. And I think that might be a really nice little pickup there.
All right. So Lackey being maybe the biggest impact addition of the offseason. Where's the spot do you think that they may have wanted to improve a little bit, but just didn't quite get everything done that they had hoped? Is there a spot?
I don't know. I think they're still sort of sorting out the bench, so they have to figure out that, you know, and that's every team in spring training, as you know, who's going to be the backup outfielder, infielder kind of guy. You know, do they have enough right-handed bats, left-handed bats, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure. I don't know the guys on the non-roster list well enough to say who might have, if there's anybody there that would have an edge. That's also another part of spring training that I sort of enjoy is watching to see who emerges from that group. I'm not just because I picked Lackey doesn't mean I don't think that Hayward's going to be a key guy, and I don't think that Zobrist is going to be a key guy, but I just, pitching is so big, and it's, you know, their bullpen is really pretty set. With all the young players, they're pretty set. It's just, there's just little tweaks that need to be done.
Well, all right, fair enough. You know, the other two, it's funny, you know, that a team could sign somebody like Jason Hayward. And really, you know, here we are, well past the halfway mark in this podcast, and his name hasn't come up a whole lot. How big an addition do you think he is to this equation?
Well, I like him a lot, and I think it's a key move that they had, primarily because he's really motivated. When he was deciding which team to sign with this offseason, he looked at the Cubs and their roster and saw the young kids and saw the potential, and that's the team he picked. I mean, it's you know, he turned down more money on other teams. He'll be a nice addition. I hear fans asking all the time, you know, aren't the Cubs going to get another outfielder? Don't they need another center fielder if they can put Hayward back and right? Hayward doesn't seem upset about playing center field at all. I don't understand all the angst over that, unless Cub fans just like to have angst for the sake of it. But Hayward seems fine with it, and Joe Maddon seems fine with it. And you put Jorge Soler in right field and maybe rotate, who knows, you know, Chris Coughlin could get some action out there. Javi Baez, you know, we'll see what happens in spring training where Javi's going to play. I mean, it's, you know, Hayward seems okay with center, and it fits at the top of the lineup, and it should be good to go.
Got to be packed up and ready to go. It's here before you know it.
Yeah, you know, in some ways this always sneaks up on me, but, you know, certainly with the Super Bowl now in the rearview mirror, I mean, it's going to be baseball season really soon here, which is very encouraging considering I woke up this morning, looked out the window, and saw snow on the ground again. So I'm heading down to Jupiter over the weekend, the coming weekend. Cardinals have their pitchers and catchers reporting midweek next week, and, you know, from there it's full go. So certainly, you know, it's been an interesting offseason in many ways, a lot more to talk about than actually went on. But, you know, I think this sets up to be a very exciting season ahead for this organization. And, you know, for me, I certainly look forward to the stories that are going to be there to document.
So total bizarre kind of out of bounds question, but if you're to take a 6-week stretch of the calendar year, are there any 6 weeks that pass quicker than January and the first 2 weeks of February?
No, I don't think so. You know, it is interesting because, you know, you get through the Christmas and New Year's holidays, and you look at the calendar and you still feel like you have quite a while before baseball season's going to sneak up on you, and then it is just here. And I think, you know, with the Cardinals having their winter warm-up event, we have been so spoiled here in St. Louis with some very warm weather, so taking advantage of that. And it has passed by in a jiffy. This the off season does. You know, it's funny. I get the question all the time from readers and fans. You know, what in the world do you do during the off season? And it's interesting because we stay much busier than I think people, you know, maybe on the surface realize. But there is always stuff going on, and in many ways, that makes these three and a half months of the off season all go by very fast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and oddly enough, it really there hasn't been a ton with the Cardinals, right? I mean, that's just it. I feel like we've had this conversation week by week, and we keep thinking, like, well, when's that big deal come? When's that trade? When's that signing? And this seems like an offseason that's more marked by who is no longer a Cardinal, maybe, than who is. And that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it has been oddly quiet in that way, it seems to me.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, it has been defined more by, you know, even the misses than the hits. And, you know, it's funny just in kind of engaging with readers even now, you know, the first, second week of February, you know, I'm still regularly getting questions about what are the Cardinals going to do? Who are they going to add? Don't they need an outfielder? And, you know, we've spent the last kind of 3 months dissecting what, you know, many of us thought were the Cardinals' needs, and then in turn, who they were probably targeting, who we knew they were targeting on the free agent market. You know, and as you mentioned, you know, I think the biggest storylines this winter have been their inability to lure both David Price and Jason Hayward back, despite offering contracts that would have been franchise record in value had either accepted. So, you know, so much made about the two misses there. The Cardinals, you know, did add kind of complementary pieces. I mean, I think certainly Mike Leake, a guy who maybe we don't talk about as a huge addition. I think he's going to have a very big impact on this team. We talk about the team needing a rotation innings eater. He can offer that. Certainly the signings of the bullpen to kind of boost that. Jonathan Broxton coming back, coming from Korea. Jed Jerko then being traded to help on the offensive side. So they have made additions. But, yeah, as you mentioned, I think so many people – and Cardinal Nation expected this organization, since it's flush with money, to go out and make a big splash this winter. And it didn't come to fruition. So, you know, in many ways, I do sense that there's a little bit of disappointment among the fan base, but the Cardinals have been very firm and very consistent in their message all along that, you know, once they had to move past Hayward, they're really intent on giving some of their young players an opportunity to succeed. And, you know, we're gonna see if that's a strategy that works out or one that backfires.
Yeah, you talk to people around baseball, though, Jen, and they all have such, you know, gigantic respect for the Cardinals organization. And even though the Cubs have made a big splash and they're the team on the come in the division, I do think there's a prevailing sentiment out there that, well, okay, we'll see if the Cardinals give up that top spot first. And then the other part of that is people always seem to say, well, the Cardinals just have a way of knowing what they need and how to do it, et cetera, and go, you know, they'll figure it out. I trust that they know what they're doing. And I feel like that is going to be tested this year, perhaps more than any other recent year. But at the same time, that discipline, that structure that they seem to adhere to so well really has served them well.
It has. And, you know, I think they've earned the benefit of the doubt. I mean, you look at the track record of general manager John Mozeliak, and he has built this club differently, you know, each of the recent years. You think back to a couple years ago when they had that really prolific offense that set a historic mark for their success with runners in scoring position. Then you think about the last 2 years, it's really been the pitching that's anchored this team. You know, they've been built in very different ways, but they have always found a way to come through. You know, I think what's interesting about this year is I feel like this year they're coming in with more risk, but I think coupled with that is also the potential for big reward. When you talk about the possibility of a Randall Grichuk and a Stephen Piscotty both getting everyday at-bats for a full season, yeah, we don't know. Neither of those players has been either A, healthy for a full Major League season, or B, on a Major League roster for a full season. What can they give you in 600 at-bats? That's a risk. But I think also when you look at the potential and the talent there, there's also the potential for a great reward, and especially when you consider the financial cost or lack thereof associated with such young players. So it is. It's going to be a different season. They're going to be tested by the Cubs. I mean, I think we can look back to the last few off seasons. The team that wins the winter doesn't necessarily win the regular season the following year. So the Cubs still have a lot to prove to themselves and you know, a lot to prove, I think, in this industry, despite the fact that most I think prognosticators are going to predict that they win the NL Central. But now, I said this all winter, it's just hard to count against the Cardinals until they give you a reason to, because of the sustained success that they've had in recent years.
And as quiet as it has been, and as you said earlier, you know, it's been more about the misses than the hits. Signing Mike Leake to a 5-year deal, bringing in Jed Jerko for John Jay, and Jerko brings so much of the versatility that they can use. You know, even a guy like Jonathan Broxton, or for that matter, Brian Pena, you know, the backup catcher. I mean, they have made moves, and in some ways, those are not small moves. I mean, Pena was one of the first catchers to be moved in the offseason or to find a new home in the offseason. Jerko, as we mentioned, you know, with versatility, the guys like Ben Zobrist and others who have become such high-ticket items, Jerko's kind of a steal in terms of value that way. And Mike Leake, I think we all know, you said it earlier, he's a guy who can gobble up some innings and add some stability to that rotation, which can already be so very good. So, in a way, they have made some really, really good moves.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I think what this organization did very well was it really pinpointed the areas of weakness last year. And if we kind of go through the list that you just mentioned, you know, number one of those being Yadier Molina's workload and how could they figure out a way to both rest their veteran catcher and then, you know, hopefully keep him healthy so he's on the field in late September and October. They did that by going to get Brian Pena, a veteran catcher in whom they can trust to carry a better, bigger workload than they did with Tony Cruz. Another deficiency of the team last year was the lack of depth on the infield. We saw Colton Wong and Johnny Peralta absolutely gassed by the time August, September came around because there was no kind of viable backup behind them. Now you go get Jed Jerko, you have another, not only a very good, you know, bat off the bench, but somebody who can spell time so the infielders are rested. You looked at another issue being the bullpen wearing down and then the wear and tear put particularly on Maness, Seegers, and Rosenthal, again, because the Cardinals didn't have enough depth that they felt comfortable with in the late inning. Now they go out, they bring Broxton back, they go get Sohn Wano, they address that. And then on the rotation side, I mean, you looked at John Lackey leaving and Lance Lynn getting hurt, and you know, that Lynn injury really changed, I think, the dynamic of this offseason for this organization. But when you talk about needing to replace 40% of your innings from last year, yes, you're getting Adam Wainwright back, and that's huge, but they also needed somebody else that they felt they could step in and count on for a 200-inning season, and they found that in Mike Leake. So they really did kind of go line by line and looked at what hurt them last year late in the season and particularly into October and addressed those changes with incremental changes. And let's not forget, too, you know, despite the fact that maybe the Cardinals didn't make the big splash that a lot of fans wanted them to, you look at the number of players injured last year who really contributed in a very limited fashion. We're talking Matt Holliday, Adam Wainwright, Jordan Wald, and Matt Adams. You're adding those guys back in a way this year, too, because you didn't have them last year. So, yes, the additions didn't all come from outside. They're also coming from a number of your key players getting healthy and hopefully staying healthy for the full season ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair point. And well taken. This team still positioned to be, you know, very, very competitive and coming off a pretty decent year. I mean, you know, they're okay. They're okay last year.
So, 100 wins. It's okay.
Yeah. You ready to go?
I am ready to go. And, you know, their general manager, David Stearns, has not taken this winter off. He has been super busy remaking the roster. It's a rebuild in Milwaukee, and that means trades. 8 of them was the count since he took over, and that didn't happen until October, basically October 1st.
Dumb question for you. You know, as a writer, you're covering those trades. You're covering the winter meetings. You're busy all winter. When some knucklehead like me says, you know, oh, we really get back to work, do you think to yourself, do you say internally, like, what do you mean? I'm always working, man.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like to tell them I'm always working, but the offseason is really quiet. And this is an annoying time of year because you go to, you know, cocktail parties, as I do all the time, as you guys know. I'm very fancy like that. But it is what everyone says at this time of year. When you go back to work, and it's like, stop reminding me that we're about to get into these 12-hour days in spring training. But look, people are excited about it, and this time of year is always so great in baseball because it coincides with spring and everything's new and the winter here in Milwaukee is about to come to an end. And I think even though people are realistic about what's going to happen with this team this year, there still is a level of interest, at least, you know. I think some people feel excitement. The Brewers tried to tap into that, I thought, interestingly, on Super Bowl Sunday when everybody's focused on Helen Mirren and the other commercials that got attention, the Brewers released a commercial that was pretty cool, you know, sort of tap into the drama of the beginning of a new year. Pretty well produced, and a lot of people were fired up about that. So, look, they're going to lose a lot. It's going to be a tough year for Craig Counsell and company, but, you know, this is baseball, and Bud Selig is the one who used to say there's always hope and faith in baseball, and I think partly because it coincides with the spring, everybody sort of taps into them a little bit.
Yeah, it is an exciting time of year. And by the way, kudos to you. You're a total pro. To reference Helen Mirren in that bit there, when really the low-hanging fruit there is Puppy Monkey Baby, but you didn't go there.
Yeah.
Stayed above the
Too
fray.
Too scary.
Yeah.
I don't think there are R rating on our podcast.
Hey, so when you look at this offseason then, from the standpoint of what David Stearns was able to get done, you know, the rebuild is a combination of things, right? You got to shed some things. You got to start building the minor league system and building talent for the future. I mean, what do you make of the various moves he was able to get done?
Well, I mean, I think he made clear very early on that he was going to go full-blown rebuild. You know, he wouldn't expressly say that when he took over publicly, but he's made trades to further the cause that was started before he took over. You know, Stearns has traded Adam Lind and brought in a new first baseman and Chris Carter. He's made, you know, some big league. K-Rod is gone. They're looking at shopping Jonathan Lucroy. They've traded Gene Segura, their starting shortstop. He's gone big, and they are obviously going this, you know, full-blown tear-it-down route. And that was the message that they tried to communicate, I think, during their fan fest in late January, is hang with us here. You know, we've got a plan. And I was talking to some fans on that day, because people want to know, you know, what's this year going to be like? And look, it could be bad. You look at other teams that have gone this way. Houston had three straight 100 loss seasons. The Cubs averaged about 95 losses for five straight years. The Brewers are coming off 94. And you can't sugarcoat it, as Mark Attanasio, their owner, said. It's going to be rough. And they are selling the idea of we have a plan. And I think back to 2002, when I covered a 106-loss Brewers team, and there wasn't this plan. There was no direction for the franchise. That came in that September when Doug Melvin took over as general manager. They subsequently slashed the payroll, and they kind of went the build, you know, rebuild route and made some good drafts, hit on some position players, and they got to the expectations were raised a little bit here in little old Milwaukee. So now here they are again, and yes, the loss total could be somewhat similar, but what they're selling to their fans is this is a plan. Now here's the blueprint. It's happened in other places. It's worked, and that's what we're trying to do. So the question is going to be how this, you know, impacts things at the turnstiles, because the Brewers are a team that relies on attendance. They do not have, say, the television dollars of other clubs. So it hurts them more when attendance takes a big hit than it does perhaps other clubs. And I think that's going to be a big question as we go through the season, is how big a hit are they going to take at the turnstiles?
Well, and you mentioned the Chris Carter deal. There's a little flash for the fans. The guy's going to hit some home runs, and certainly it's all or nothing when he's up there. That'll help. They signed Capuano to a minor league deal, and who knows if he ends up contributing or not, but there's a nice connection there. When you look at the moves Stearns made, which one stands out to you as one that you think might be most impactful, whether it's this year or down the line? Which trade do you think did them the best?
Well, you know, Dave, I'm guessing if I say that, because the nature of the deals, the overwhelming majority of deals have been these long-term, you know, you trade an established player now for a prospect who could help you way down the line. And I don't think even David Stearns and his crew know how those trades are going to work out. You cannot, in baseball, predict. So, you know, in the short term, Chris Carter is the guy who's going to have the biggest impact. He's going to bat perhaps four. Some of the projections say he's a 30 homer guy at Miller Park. He's opposite field. He should play well in that ballpark. And he's a guy who still has club control left. So this isn't a one-year thing. It's, you know, a one-year contract that he signed, but then the club will have control of him if they wish in arbitration beyond. So, you know, that's one that stands out as, okay, we're going to see this guy this year. But these other trades are going to be more long-term. And the Gene Segura trade stands out. That was David Stern's biggest trade in terms of the number of players involved and in the potential payoff. And because in return, he gets a guy, Chase Anderson, a pitcher who's going to help now, Aaron Hill, a veteran who's going to help now. But then it's that shortstop they got in the deal, a 19-year-old, Eason Diaz. There was a lot of talk of him at the team's fan fest, a player that the Brewers people are really high on. But look, he's 19 years old. So the best case scenario is maybe 3 years. You know, he was in the Pioneer League last season where he was MVP. Probably 4 years, 5 years. So it just reinforces, these deals reinforce the idea that this is going to be a long-term deal, this project, this rebuilding project, and it's going to require patience on the part of the people paying for those tickets.
Adam, very shortly on his way to spring training, before we get to today's podcast, or the meat of it anyway, Adam, I really think we should talk for a moment about Tom Singer, who for many years, 15 years, MLB.com. Last year was on the Pirates beat. Just a generally wonderful person. And sadly, we got the news this week that his long fight with illness has taken him. Just your thoughts on Tom Singer and your time experiences getting to know him.
Yeah, it's been kind of a tough week for us here in Pittsburgh, and really for the entire MLB.com family, when we all found out that Tom had passed. He meant a lot to a lot of people, and I think it's always sad that it takes, you know, such a tragic thing for opinions to come out, but like the outpouring of emotion and support and respect for Tom that we saw the last couple days was really incredible. I mean, he was trending on Twitter at one point, which I'm sure he probably would have, you know, shot down and said it was a slow news night or something like that. But spending last year with Tom was really a pleasure for me. I learned a lot about Pittsburgh, which was his adopted hometown. And I learned a lot about the Pirates, which were, you know, which they were his favorite team growing up. So he really had a lot to share. He's a really great writer and a great storyteller, which is great because he had a ton of stories to tell about his life and covering baseball for so many years. And I think the impressive thing to me was that he never lost his passion for baseball, which is something that, like, doing what we do, it's kind of easy to get cynical and jaded and, got to go to the ballpark today. But like, Tom never had a day like that, which was really incredible and really inspiring. And I think you saw that. It touched a lot of people, not just within our community and the baseball writing and MLB.com family, but also with the Pirates. I mean, you saw Garrett Cole, Clint Hurdle, and a whole lot of others say how much Tom meant to them. So it's all very well deserved, and we're definitely going to miss Tom.
He, we spent many an hour doing podcasts, and our producer, Danny Wexelman, who never gets enough credit for what she does for these podcasts, but we chuckled all the time. We had so much fun with Tom because – invariably, week by week, and this is now a standard you'll have to live up to, Adam. He would do the podcast from the airport tram that's going from terminal to terminal, or he'd do. I remember one day, I think it was July 4th, and he was in incredible traffic going to the ballpark for a day game, and fighting the traffic, doing the podcast, and of course all of it every time in the most cheerful disposition. And as you pointed out, and I think maybe one of the really enduring personality traits that Tom leaves behind is that genuine love and curiosity every day. And like you said, 162 games, spring training, it piles up. And it's understandable that some guys just occasionally treat a day like just another day. He never, ever did.
No, and it's you talk about that curiosity for the game. I'm sure something you noticed and the listeners and readers all did is that Tom would always have like these crazy facts and bits of information and history and trivia and context that nobody else did, because he always took like such a unique look and angle at each event, each play. You know, he wondered if something had ever happened before, when the last time it was. And, you know, you talk about curiosity and just a work ethic and love of the game. Like, everything was important to him. And even if it wasn't necessarily important to other people, like, he would, you know, he would bring up these facts to Clint Hurdle before the game, and Clint would just kind of look back and smile and say, yeah, Tom, that is interesting. Because there's not, you know, there's only so much you could say about stats and stuff like that, but Tom loved it, and I think that enthusiasm for the game really was contagious to be around.
Well, with heavy hearts, we say goodbye, and we, of course, offer our love and support to Malvina, his wife, family left mm-hmm. behind, a couple of sons, Jason and Sean, and just a really, really sad bit of news right on the cusp of spring training, which is the news that it grabs most people's attention this time of year. And so you're on your way, Adam. I know you're heading down to Pirate City in Bradenton, going to be there very soon. Let's look back at this offseason. What maybe was the biggest move, most important move you think this team made this year?
I think the most important thing they had to do entering the offseason was replacing A.J. Burnett and Jay Happ in the rotation. So just purely in terms of things they had to get done, I think trading Neil Walker for John Neese turned out to be pretty important. He's not a flashy acquisition. He may not have the upside of Burnett or the unexpected upside that Happ showed last year, but he's a pretty solid left-hander, and there's a lot of reason to believe that Ray Searidge can work some magic with him, as he did with Happ and as he's done with countless others throughout the last couple of years. So I thought that was a fairly important move, and while it's tough for the Pirates to trade away Neil Walker, and as tough as it was for Pittsburgh to see, you know, a native guy leave, I think the fact that they had Josh Harrison to step in and replace Walker made it kind of a natural move there. But the other move that I'll point out is one they didn't make, which was trading Mark Melanson. At this point, he is set to be their closer once again, and they've made a lot of moves to supplement their bullpen in front of Melanson and set up man Tony Watson. So I think they've added to a strength in their bullpen, but it would not have been quite as strong if they had traded Melanson.
Let me ask you about Melanson. There was a time there where it looked like he very much was going to get traded. I thought there was plenty of interest. There no doubt was interest in Melanson. Pirates sure seemed to be open to the notion. What happened? Why did they not trade him? Because I'm with you on this one. He's a beauty and well yeah. worth keeping. What happened? Did they just one day wake up and say, like, what are we doing? Of course we're not trading Melanson.
Yeah, I think they're you know, Neil Huntington's thing the whole offseason was that they don't have to trade Melanson. So they were going to wait to get blown away. And if that offer never materialized, then they weren't going to force it. You know, they didn't have to trade him, and they didn't necessarily even want to. So at that point, you know, you're probably right. They did ask themselves, well, why would we bother? You know, if they can hold on to Melanson, if they can afford him, which they did with some of the other moves they made, trading Charlie Morton, I think, was a pretty big key to them being able to afford Melanson's, you know, $9.5-ish million salary for this season. So, yeah, I mean, they didn't have to trade him. They didn't want to trade him. So if they didn't get an offer that made them change their mind, why would they? And obviously they didn't.
Mark, you know, we look at the off season for the Cincinnati Reds. And if you want to evaluate the offseason, this is the rebuild. So I don't know if we look first at who was dealt and not dealt, or who they got or were trying to get. Where do you go with this?
Well, I'm sure if you're the Reds, you want to look forward and not back. Of course, fans and myself, even with media, you can't help but look at the fact that they've given up the best closer they've ever had in Aroldis Chapman and a really good third baseman, Todd Frazier. So those guys are gone, and they got prospects in return, and whose value or whose strengths have yet to be seen, just because they're new or they're unproven. So it'll be to evaluate these deals, it's almost like you have to watch it on the field.
Well, and it's going to be impossible, really. I mean, we can, I guess, throw an opinion out there on you know, how do they do in the Frazier deal, or how do they do in the Chapman trade? The reality is we won't know, and we might not know even next summer. I mean, it can be a while until some of these guys mature enough or have the opportunities to know whether or not they're really going to make it, right?
That's correct. I mean, especially with the Chapman trade, because of all the exterior issues that were going around as far as the allegations of domestic abuse and things like that, they may not have gotten the value they would have gotten for him had that not happened, or if they had traded him during the season. So they like a couple of the guys they got in that trade. They like a couple of the guys they got in the Frazier trade, and we'll see how it goes. It's just it really was a different offseason, because usually for the Reds, when they're looking at contending and they're aiming at winning the NL Central, it's always about adding that missing piece that will put them over the top. And a lot of times it's a left fielder, like it was last winter for Marlon Byrd, and they were hoping that guy would take them where they want to go. And this year it's more about taking them to the future.
Well, I mean, staying on the Chapman thing, a lot of ways, I thought it was pretty incredible that they were able to get it done, right? That they were, you know, they had it done, and then the allegations came out. It blew up the deal with the Dodgers. That the Yankees were able to come swooping in and make a deal. I just feel like from a Red standpoint, he was a guy who needed to be moved. You don't know how much more trouble is waiting to surround him, quite honestly. I think just getting out from underneath the whole Chapman story was a victory in a way.
It is and it isn't. I mean, you know, no, I mean, he ended up not being charged with the crime. He's still awaiting discipline from Major League Baseball once they complete their investigation. So we'll see how that turns out. He might get suspended. But you just wonder, with that trade, you just kind of wonder what if they were able to find a match during the season, whether it was with the Yankees, the Astros, the Diamondbacks, the whoever, during, you know, July 31st, and you kind of wonder what that haul would have been as opposed to what they ended up getting. And they, you know, they got a couple of good guys. I mean, Rookie Davis and Eric DeGuilo are the two kind of top prospects of that trade. They have a lot of promise. And again, in a couple of years, we'll know if that trade, if they got enough for Chapman. It's just with Chapman, it's just a hard thing to evaluate, because he is such a unique talent. There's not a lot of closers that do what he does and has the strikeout rate that he brings. So it's difficult to rate that trade like any other trade, just because there's no way they were going to get that kind of talent in return, no matter when they made that trade. But you kind of wonder what could have been if it happened a different time.
All right. Well, Todd Frazier, that's a three-team deal, but they ended up getting four players back, right? So it's just, in terms of quantity, and I've seen these before, where sometimes teams, you know, obviously you want to get the best prospect you can, but sometimes just quantity can make a huge difference, right? And four, you know, getting four guys back for Frazier, what do you know? I mean, what do you know? Is there a feeling internally that they did pretty well on this one?
They were pretty happy with that trade. They got what they viewed as a very high prospect in Jose Peraza, and they're very happy with him. He's a guy that kind of represents the potential future, leadoff guy. It's actually, they got three players in that trade.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Brandon Dixon and Scott Schebler and Jose Peraza for Todd Frazier. And, he's a guy that can be the second baseman of the future if they can figure out what happens with Brandon Phillips. He could play center field. He could play shortstop, his natural position, when he was with the Braves organization. So, he doesn't hit for power, but he does hit, and he's a 300 hitter lifetime in the minors, and he can steal some bases. So that's a lot of promise. They're pretty happy with Schebler, who's a left-handed hitter, kind of a corner outfielder, and they have an opening in left field. So if he was able to step up and be that guy, they would be pretty pleased with that. And so if what they really wanted to set out to do is rebuild their minor league system, they had kind of used it up pretty good to make some trades when they were contending. The Matt Latos trade was a particular one, where they sent three young guys in Edinson Volquez to San Diego to get Latos. And they've made a couple of other deals that are similar to get in, you know, to get guys they needed when they needed them for contending. And then once that kind of hurt their system this year, they got a little exposed. They didn't have a lot of guys to bring up from AAA when things went south this year. So they really kind of aimed at you know, during the summer they worked on the pitching staff and the trades for Cueto and Leak, and then in the and Bird, and then in the draft they did that, and then also in this winter they really wanted to stock up on young position players.
I need to apologize too, Mark. My math is so terrible. You know, you work three teams in a deal, and I'm gonna get terribly confused tonight.
The Reds wish they got four players.
I'd say it's spring training for all of us, but we're still a week away from that. But you know, the Frazier deal, and you bring up Jose Peraza, obviously the big piece of that, which then I guess leads us to the trade that wasn't made, right? The deal that hasn't been done, and that's Brandon Phillips. And to me, there's really the I don't know what the word I want to use here. The disappointment of the offseason, the frustration of this offseason. Yeah, he needs to be moved, and that needs to be a part of their rebuild, but they're just having a heck of a time getting that done.
Yeah. The Cincinnati Inquirer had reported that one of the caravan stops at Walt Jocketty said there was even a second possible trade that Phillips had mixed. It was to Arizona, which I guess was probably the trade that for Aaron Hill that the Brewers ended up pulling off a week or two ago. Segura. So yeah, that's between that and Washington, which didn't happen, is the mystery. I don't know if we'll ever know from Phillips or if he'll articulate why he decided to turn those trades down. It sounded like a lot of it was contractual, that he really wanted to be compensated for waiving his 10-5 rights, which is certainly within his parameters or his purview. But as far as the Reds' point of view is, it kind of does stall a little bit, at least that one spot, a chance to look ahead. They're going to kind of have to spend the next at least 2 years with Phillips, and while he'll be a definitely a valuable player for that position, he's a good second baseman still. He's not what he once was, but he's still very good. He came back last year and had a nice season offensively too. But if you're trying to rebuild and there's no chance he's going to be here after that contract is over when they're ready to compete again, it doesn't really serve the Reds' purposes too well. So kind of see what happens with him. It'll be interesting how that goes down. Brian Price said that even though Peraza's here, that he expects Phillips to be a second baseman regularly.